Today in Studio 360, what is the best way to get a lot of attention and big audiences? Well, if you're Alice Cooper, put on a bunch of makeup. But Kiss and Bowie were already doing that. How about killing yourself on stage every night in a different way?
Rock and roll was full of rock and roll heroes. There was a million Peter Pans and no Captain Hook.
I'll talk with Alice Cooper about becoming Alice Cooper later in the hour. Plus...
Hello, I'm Nick Offerman. You may know me as Ron Swanson from the show Parks and Recreation, but I'm also a real-life woodworker.
And he's got a woodworking challenge for all of you. Don't worry, you won't have to go to the lumberyard. All that and more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show, if you're a fan or student of James Bond, you do pay attention whenever a new Bond actor is announced. He's been played by Sean Connery, Roger Moore, Pierce Brosnan, Daniel Craig, all variously suave and, of course, all white. Among the supposed favorites to play 007 next is the great black British actor Idris Elba, Stringer Bell in The Wire and the star of the BBC detective series Luther. Earlier this week, Anthony Horowitz, author of the new James Bond novel called Trigger Mortis, told a British newspaper he just couldn't see Elba in the role. Elba, he said, was, quote, a bit too rough, a bit too street. Surprise, surprise, the internet reacted. A few of those outraged tweets came from Jameel Smith, senior editor at The New Republic and host of Intersection, a podcast about race, gender, and identity. And he joins me now. Jameel, welcome to Studio 360.
Appreciate you having me.
So this guy, Anthony Horowitz, who, by the way, apologized and said I'm mortified and I was a poor choice of words and blah, blah, blah. But when Horowitz called Idris Elba too street to play Bond, what does that phrase suggest to you?
The guy obviously, to some degree, did not know what he was saying, just to give him the slight benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
But he has to understand it. You know, I mean, the word street has been a euphemism for black for a long time. Urban. All, right. You know, ethnic. This isn't something that, like, you know, oh, gosh, you know, I don't pay attention to the news or to pop culture, so I don't know the latest sayings. No, this is something that has been used as a euphemism since, frankly, James Bond has come into the world's consciousness. So he doesn't really have a pass on that. But the point to me is that, you know, saying that he's a little too street is curious, considering that James Bond is a thug in a suit.
Yes. And not a guy from the upper class. He's a spy who kills people.
And not just a guy from the upper class, but he's a Scot, which, I mean, has its own issues when it comes to UK culture.
Yes.
Okay. So you're talking about a Scottish guy from the country.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Who kills people for a living.
No, and that's interesting because this is a guy who obviously has thought about Bond a lot, wrote a Bond novel. So he doesn't get a pass on what looks like a kind of literary mistake or misguidedness.
Exactly. Frankly, it's about, you know, the fact that Anthony Horowitz seems to be, you know, stuck in this old idea of what a hero should look like.
Right. And you made an interesting point in one of your tweets about the Sidney Poitier, Jim Brown paradigm and how this reminds you of it. Explain that.
Okay. So the actor that he recommended, that Horowitz recommended for the role, was Adrian Lester. Adrian Lester, for all of his credits, is not a threatening guy in the least. I mean, he is the quintessential nice guy. There is not a threatening bone in Adrian Lester's body.
So he's the Sidney Poitier in this.
He's the Sidney Poitier in this equation.
Yeah.
So basically the paradigm is this. In the 60s, you know, Sidney Poitier portrayed respectable black men on film. He was not going to be the guy who was expected to be physical. Those roles were reserved for Jim Brown, for Fred Williamson, Jim Kelly. Those were the guys who needed to, like, get rough. And this was very well explained in Spike Lee's documentary about Jim Brown called Jim Brown All-American, which I highly recommend people look up. And, you know, this was the guy who was called upon to do the rough stuff, to be the Mandingo, essentially, you know, if we want to characterize it with the stereotype.
Yeah. Do you think in the James Bond context, there would be a problem that these movie makers think about, like, well, it's one thing for this white guy to kill people like crazy, but we're just – it's going to freak white audiences out if a black guy is doing it.
Yeah. No, there's a certain question you have to ask yourself. Like, what will it do to a largely white audience to see a black guy killing mostly white people?
Yeah.
But I think especially in Britain, I mean, we've already seen this. John Luther has a gun. John Luther is a vicious, violent man,
yeah,
you know, who is on the side of good. I mean, the archetype is out there. It's not something that I think should shock people. And frankly, if the people that it does shock, I'm glad they're shocked.
And interestingly, thinking about the incredible global base of movies in general today, and especially of movies like the James Bond ones, maybe most of the people who go see them aren't white.
Right. Imagine that.
It seems like there is a lot of momentum in the fan world, maybe in the entertainment world, for having a black Bond. Is that just, we elected a black president and he's got a real license to kill, so we can make a black Bond in the movies? I mean, what is that part of it?
That might be an interesting interpretation. But what I think is really at the heart of it is that, you know, we're seeing in our world now people being more open, or at least being forced to be more open, to the idea of everyone looking like a hero. I think there's still a long way to go. But I think, you know, folks have been swallowing a blonde-haired, blue-eyed Jesus for eons
because
now.
He was.
Well, no, sorry to break it to you.
So if and when they cast a black guy as Bond, will that be a big deal, do you think? Will it be a big deal for the 12-year-old yous out there?
I think it'll be a big deal. Yeah, I think it would be a big deal for the 12-year-old me's. When I was growing up, I didn't have any black heroes outside of, you know, blaxploitation movies. I saw Shaft. He was a black hero. Jim Brown, you know, all these guys. But seeing like a black guy being James Bond with the kind of legend that James Bond carries, yeah, I think would have a big impact on a kid, especially, you know, there's a 12-year-old kid who's in Brixton in London right now,
right,
black kid, who doesn't have any heroes to look up to. And to see James Bond 007 and see Idris Elba's face there, I think that would do a lot for his self-confidence.
How about an Asian Bond? How about a female Bond?
Oh, female Bond would be amazing.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, that I think that, you know, I'm all for stretching the boundaries of that character in any which way they can go. If you find the most qualified, most interesting actor that can take it in an interesting direction while still maintaining the spirit of the series, why not?
Jamil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can hear more of Jamil Smith on his podcast, Intersection. Alice Cooper has maybe died more often, more dramatically, and in front of more people than any performer ever, certainly any musician. His highly theatrical rock shows have variously ended with depictions of him being electrocuted, beheaded, and hanged. In real life, he has managed to survive very nicely by all appearances, and now in his 60s, he keeps on rocking. He's got a new album with Johnny Depp coming out this month, and he is still performing those over-the-top live shows all over the world. The man known as Alice Cooper joins me now. Sir, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
And what do your friends call you? Not Alice.
You know, I'll tell you, everybody calls me Coop.
Yeah?
And that came from Groucho Marx. I got to know Groucho very well in Los Angeles in his later years. And he used to come to the show, and he would go, "Alice is the last hope for vaudeville," which I thought was the best compliment I ever got
Absolutely.
In my life, you know. But he would bring, like, Fred Astaire.
Really?
Mae West, George Burns, Jack Benny to the show, all vaudevillians, you know. And they would watch the show, and everybody in the audience would be freaking out about everything, and they'd be watching the show going, "Yeah, Gracie and I in Toledo, 1927, saw the guy do the guillotine like that," you know.
We were
sitting there going, like, you know, these guys were like the best of the best.
Yeah. And it's interesting because vaudeville is what you were doing.
It is. Psychedelic vaudeville, hard rock vaudeville.
Your first single was released when you were 17, and it's called "Why Don't You Love Me?"
Right.
I want to play a bit of that. Cool record.
I love that.
Yeah, me too. So how did that record come to be?
Well, you know, we were the exact right age to be affected by the British invasion.
Right.
We were 15, 16. I'm painting the house, you know, in the summertime, and I always had the radio on. And all of a sudden I hear, da-dum, da-dum, she loves you, yeah, yeah. And I went, what was that? Yeah, I'd never heard anything like that. It was like the spark that you know, every guy I knew in school wanted to be now in a band.
Right. And so you record the single. Did you think, okay, I'm on my way, this is it?
Well, we were just a little, you know, just an awful little band that played parties, and we learned maybe 8 songs.
Yeah.
The four guys, 3 guys on the team, in the band, were all on the cross-country track team. We were all jocks.
Huh.
4-year letterman, all of us.
Huh.
So, you know, this horrific Alice Cooper band was actually jocks.
Yeah.
And pretty wholesome. And then the other 2 guys we got in the band were pure juvenile delinquents. I mean, these guys were kicked out of school every day.
So that helped. So you could keep it real.
So we had some, had some street cred. You know?
the earliest song of yours that people probably know is I'm 18 and This Is That. Now, 1971 was different than 1965, but there's a big change in you, in the way you sound in those 6 years. I mean, there's this, like, rawness and intensity in the voice.
Well, there was Bob Ezrin, our producer, came in and saw us play and realized that we were a band that had a lot of elements, but we didn't have, like, a focus. And he kept saying, dumb it down. Keep making it dumber, because it's, I'm 18 and I don't get what I want, you know. One of the first punk songs, really. But an anthem.
Totally.
Every 18-year-old kid totally got that. I'm a boy and I'm a man. I'm 18. And the hook was, and I like it.
Which had all kinds of dirty implication.
Yeah. So there it was. It was, and you had to fit this little single that didn't make any sense into where the Supremes, Simon and Garfunkel, the Beatles. It had to fit in this top 40, and it did somehow.
Yeah. And it was a little Jim Morrison-y.
Yeah, yeah. It had some. It wasn't as sophisticated as the Doors, but it was definitely Detroit rock.
So do you, like a song like I'm 18, do you still play that?
That song is essential in the show.
Yeah.
That's the one song when we start the show. I do it with a crutch, you know.
Yeah.
I'm 18. I say I'm singing 18, not 80, okay?
Yeah. So you were doing it, I mean— Alice Cooper in the 70s was this sort of less serious vaudevillian thing, and so at 60 you can do it in the same.
I play Alice now even more of a villain. He was a villain then. He's even a better villain now.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, rock and roll was full of rock and roll heroes. There was a million Peter Pans and no Captain Hook.
Good point.
And I said, well, I'll gladly be Captain Hook because that's more fun than being Peter Pan.
Yeah.
And
you
really,
can do it for longer.
Yeah, and not only that, but I mean, I had the face for it. I had the, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a villainous-looking guy.
So you mentioned punk. I mean, that was, unlike punk, unlike the serious we're going to change the world stuff in rock and roll in the late 60s, you were never conveying an idea that you were serious about we're going to change the world.
And we were never politically motivated at all.
Yeah.
We were much more... well, at the time, you have to remember now, here's Alice Cooper, 1969, 1970. I've got eye makeup on. I'm wearing, you know, a pair of black leather pants, my girlfriend's slip that's ripped to pieces with blood all over it, which begs the audience to go, what happened? What just happened there? You know, because it scared a lot of people.
Did it actually? I guess it did.
Oh, yeah. Because there was nothing
like a parody of parents.
But there was nothing to compare it to.
Right, right, right.
And so we were suddenly satanic.
Yeah.
We were suddenly the worst thing that could ever happen. And people were inventing things about Alice Cooper. I would come into a town and there'd be 9 new rumors. And the ASPCA was there and the FBI was there and everything. And I'm going, wow, this is really good.
Which is interesting, given that you... Again, unlike other bands that had actual political ambitions, you were a vaudevillian.
Not at all. We were, you know, there were some bands that were into politics and change the world. We were into blondes and Corvettes.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Yeah.
All the right reasons to be in rock and roll.
all the real reasons, mostly. At that time, you were living, again, not what Alice Cooper should be doing, living in a mansion in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Well, now we had some money. You have to remember, we had a number one album now, you know, and by this time we're headlining. And so we've got enough money to actually get out of the hotels and into a house. And so the band moved into a house in Greenwich, Connecticut, which where we way didn't belong. I mean, Greenwich was blue blood, bleeding everywhere. And here we were. Our hair was literally down to our waist. And we would go into town and people would hide.
It's barely to his shoulders now.
Yeah, it's very conservative now. And yet we were not the most disturbing thing on the block.
What was that?
Bette Davis lived next door.
At a fairly advanced age.
Yes. And she would drive her XKE about 100 miles an hour down these roads.
Awesome.
And she was a party in herself. She would come over and ask us to turn the music up.
Really?
And this was loud rock and roll. She was something.
I want that reality show.
Yeah, that would have been great, you know. And I told her, I said, you did play a part in Alice Cooper. And she goes, what? And I said, look, when I was designing the character, there were two things that I really liked. I saw Barbarella and the Black Queen. Then I saw Whatever Happened to Baby Jane.
That's
the
a scary
old
character.
Woman with the caked-on makeup trying to look young, with the makeup cracking and the eyes not quite right. I said, that's the makeup for Alice.
And how did she take that?
She thought it was great. You know, I said, that was one of the scariest characters ever was Baby Jane.
For sure. Your father was a Christian fundamentalist lay minister.
Yes.
I read. Did being in that fundamentalist biblical environment to some degree, did that affect how you designed this evil character?
Well, it was funny because I was the prodigal son. I grew up in the church. I was in church on Friday night, all day Sunday, Wednesday night. All my friends were church kids. And then when the ban happened, it pulled me away to L.A. and I became the poster boy for everything wrong, you know, that could possibly be wrong. And then came back to the church about 25 years ago. Back to the church, yeah.
That same church?
No, different church, but Christian church.
Uh-huh.
And pretty much when I quit drinking, changed my lifestyle, and that my wife and I – my wife's also a preacher's kid. Huh. Her dad's a Baptist pastor. Huh. And, you know, now we're all Christians and everything's cool.
And, okay, there is still the imagery in the show. Does that still freak out people?
I think it might – you know, I mean, I think if people don't have fun with my show now on a level of, yeah, it's scary, and at the same time, you should have your tongue – solidly in your cheek on this. There's nothing satanic in it. There's never any nudity. There's never bad language in my show. I would never allow any bad language in my show. The Alice villain is a gentleman.
Uh-huh.
Now, he might slit your throat, but he would never swear at you.
Yeah.
You know, and I throw a little Clouseau in there too.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't mind him slipping on a banana peel once in a while.
Yeah, yeah. One of the iconic stories about you that a lot of people know is that this live chicken got ripped apart on stage. What happened there? What is the definitive story?
It's a great story. We're at the Toronto Peace and Love Festival.
Nice.
Okay. 1969. And we're playing between The Doors and John Lennon and Yoko Ono. At the end of our show, we open up feather pillows and CO2 cartridges, and it looks like a blizzard on stage with lights going, strobe lights. It looks spectacular. Lennon's over here and John and Morrison's over here, and they're going, this is great, you know, because it's a freak out, you know. The next thing I look on the stage and there's a chicken. There's a white chicken on stage. Now, I know I didn't bring it. We didn't bring it, but there it was. And I'm figuring, well, somebody in the audience, see, I got my keys, I got my wallet, got my chicken. Time to go to Alice's show. They throw it on stage.
It's Canada.
Well, I've never been on a farm in my life, so it had feathers, it had wings, it should fly. So I picked it up and I chucked it in the audience, figuring it would fly a little bit. Somebody would get it, take it home, and have a nice pet. The audience tore it to pieces. Now, the thing that was the kicker to the story was that the first six rows were all in wheelchairs. They're the ones that tore the...
Is that true?
Yes. And threw the parts back on stage. Next day in the paper, Alice Cooper kills chicken and bites the head off. And Frank Zappa calls me up and he says, did you kill a chicken last night on stage? And I went, no. And he said, well, don't tell anybody. They love it.
Yeah.
He says, they're loving it. It's great.
It was like your comedy Altamont.
And I just went, okay. So from then on, I didn't deny anything.
Yeah.
Everything people made, and there was no internet then, so everything was word of mouth.
Yeah.
By the time anybody heard it, 9 chickens. It was 12
right.
chickens.
It and you
was,
did it every
I did
night.
It every night, you know.
You have this new album coming out next month with a group you've put together called The Hollywood Vampires. Tell this story. Who, what, why?
Well, The Hollywood Vampires, about 1973, we lived in L.A. And every night I found myself at the Rainbow on Sunset Strip. And Bernie Taupin and Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees and Harry Nilsson. And John Lennon, when he was there, Harry and Don were John were best of friends. Keith Moon from The Who. Every night we sat there, and it was last man standing. And they finally started calling us the Hollywood Vampires because we never saw daylight.
Really, you just drank. Sat there drinking all night?
Yeah, we just drank all night. I finally, I was doing a movie with Johnny Depp in England, Dark Shadows. And we went to play a club called the 100 Club that was about the size of these two rooms here.
Which is to say small.
And all we did was, I said, we're going to be a bar band tonight. And said, I knew Johnny was a good guitar player. And I said, Johnny, come and play with us. And he said, okay. So we started playing. And we realized that every song we played was some British invasion song that this audience loved. And I said, you know, we should really put a band together and just do nothing but
covers.
And then we started thinking, you know, all of our dead drunk friends, Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix,
Keith Moon,
all the guys that we drank with are now dead. Let's do an album in tribute to them. Let's do the Hollywood Vampires. And so we did it at Johnny Depp's house. He has a big studio in his house. Joe Perry, myself, and then people started dropping in, you know, Paul McCartney.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I saw the list of people. Paul McCartney was the one that, like, which one doesn't belong?
Yeah, no, he's a rocker, man.
There is one of the songs on the album is a T-Rex song. And here is your Hollywood Vampires cover version of Jeepster.
You're so sweet. You're so fine. I want you all.
So that's a pretty straight-ahead cut. I mean, it's harder rock,
yeah.
But it's a pretty straightforward rendition.
It was really kind of hard to imitate the sound of the 70s because there was a certain sound that those amps got, that those guitars got. And I said, we can't not be ourselves. We have to toughen this up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so every song that we attacked, you know, the way we would do it. But we stayed pretty close.
And you're going to play. You've got a big show in Rio de Janeiro.
Rock and Rio. Yeah, that's going to be fun. You know, and it's so weird for all of us because none of us have ever been in a band where it's just all celebrities.
Super,
you know?
Group.
And I've never done that. You know, so I'm really just the singer in this band.
And so the Hollywood Vampires, you'll do that for a while. How long do you foresee continuing to do Alice Cooper?
Oh, I have no intention of retiring at all.
Yeah.
I've never been in better health. You know, there's no reason for me to ever retire. I tell everybody I'm booked into next century.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, rock on, dude. Alice Cooper, this has been a pleasure.
Oh, that's fun.
The Hollywood Vampires album is out this month. Still ahead this hour, how did a musical with a flimsy plot and a score that's just a montage of ABBA songs become the longest-running Broadway show of this century?
You take your brain, you leave it on the pavement outside, you go in and you enjoy, and you pick your brain back up and you go out.
After 14 years on Broadway, Mamma Mia takes its final bow. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. This summer has broken all kinds of temperature records, so maybe you've been eating a lot of popsicles. And like most reasonable human beings, you've probably thrown the sticks away, unless you're a hoarder or a crafter, whom I've just discovered constitute the vast customer base for popsicle sticks. Either way, we've got a new challenge for you. to build something out of popsicle sticks for Nick Offerman, the guy who played Ron Swanson on Parks and Recreation.
The whole point of this country is if you want to eat garbage, balloon up to 600 pounds, and die of a heart attack at 43, you can. You are free to do so. To me, that's beautiful.
In addition to being a terrific actor and a funny writer, Offerman is also a serious carpenter and woodworker. And he's here. Nick Offerman, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you kindly.
So, before you became a world-famous actor, were you a carpenter?
Well, yes. I grew up using tools in a farm family in Illinois, which helped me a lot when I started working in theater in Chicago. I would build the scenery, and I wasn't very good yet at acting, and so people, I would trick them into giving me a small part in a play so that I would build the set. And I milked that scam for years until I became more nearly decent as an actor.
Like your character, Ron Swanson, you are a big fan of America, at least according to your books. Your latest one is very funny, called Gumption.
Oh, thank you.
It's a collection of profiles of what you call America's gutsiest troublemakers. Reading the book, I was wondering, this America love of yours, what percentage is it authentic and what percentage is it ironic? Because it seems like a hybrid.
I do think that the America that I adore is probably different than the object of Ron Swanson's affection.
Yeah.
But my love of our country is completely without irony. I admire it and sort of devote my life to this place where we can all work together to try and use our ideas and our capacity for decency to evolve the human race to one day live in a way where none of us have to shoot each other.
So this challenge that you have cooked up for us, you want people to make you something out of popsicle sticks. Anything or kinds of things in particular that they should be creating?
Well, sure. First, I would amend your earlier comment. Instead of throwing away your popsicle sticks, I would always encourage you to save them because they make great kindling for the grill or your campfire.
Good point.
But now I want everyone to save them and build something inspired, perhaps along the themes of some of my favorite notions like the bratwurst, fishing, masonry, Wilco, the Hoover Dam and the secrets therein. Puzzles in general fascinate me, and or America herself. I think that those are all wonderful places to get your ideas started.
And by Wilco, we mean the band?
Yeah, the seminal American rock and roll band, Wilco.
Uh-huh. So the people will build their things and enter not by sending you or us their object yet. They'll just send us pictures.
Yeah.
And then you'll pick the winner or winners.
That sounds like a good plan. And unless someone were to construct a Ford F-250, in that case, if you drive that to Los Angeles, I will immediately declare you the winner.
Nick Offerman, thank you very much, and we will talk again as the competition proceeds and after you've picked a winner.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Kurt, and happy gluing, everybody.
You've got until September 28th to be part of Nick Offerman's Ultimate Popsicle Stick Throwdown. You can enter by posting a photo of your creation to Instagram or Twitter with the hashtag MadeForNick, or send it to studio360.org. In any Broadway season, there are hits, and then there are hits. Those record-breaking shows that stick around for a generation. A Chorus Line was a Broadway fixture from when I was in college through my mid-30s. Cats from my late 20s well into middle age. Well, one such juggernaut is about to close after 14 years on Broadway. Tobin Low has the story of how Mamma Mia became such a giant hit in spite of being, you know, Mamma Mia.
We see a lot of theater. We're big fans of the theater.
This is Debbie Miller of Westchester, New York. She's not kidding when she says she sees a lot of Broadway shows.
I would say it's possibly up around 15 a year.
And out of all those shows, there's a couple she hasn't liked that much. Down at the bottom is Mamma Mia.
It wasn't the worst thing that I've ever seen. It was an enjoyable evening, okay? That I will give it.
In fact, Debbie has a hard time remembering what Mamma Mia is even about. She knows there's a girl.
I think she was about to get married, and she wanted to have her father at the wedding.
And her mom's three former lovers who could possibly be her dad.
And that's about all I remember from the show.
So it's kind of a flimsy story.
It's stupid, but it's so much fun.
This is David Meyer. He's a big fan of the show, and not because he thinks it's a great musical.
You take your brain, you leave it on the pavement outside, you go in and you enjoy, and you pick your brain back up and you go out.
Karen Mason played one of the leads in the original Broadway cast. She remembers the anticipation for the show's arrival.
It was really exciting to be part of that original company because we knew that it was going to be a big hit.
And why wouldn't it be? It was sparkly, it was silly, it had a full playlist of ABBA hits, Dancing Queen, Waterloo. Even if the show was kind of fluffy, audiences abroad had loved it. So why wouldn't New Yorkers? Karen remembers heading into the city for rehearsal a couple weeks before opening night. It was September 2001.
I was coming out of the subway at Union Square, and here was all these stalled people, and I looked up.
From where she stood, Karen watched a plane hit the second tower of the World Trade Center.
And it totally immobilizes you. Your feet do not move. And you can't comprehend what you're watching.
Mamma Mia had an opening date set for October, and the producers decided to forge ahead. Rehearsals continued, but the tone had changed.
Everybody wanted to be out helping and finding a meaning for what was going on. And yet here we were wearing snorkels and singing Chiquitita. And you just go, wow, how do I put this all together? How does this make sense to me?
A bunch of other shows just went gone because no one was going. Tourists weren't coming in. New Yorkers weren't leaving their houses.
This is David again. He was living in the city at the time. He had seen Mamma Mia in London before and thought it was fun, but he didn't love it. When the show came to New York, he decided to see it again. So not long after September 11th, David found himself in the theater, watching that same girl try to find her father.
The show opened up, and it opens up with I Have a Dream.
I have a dream, a song to sing, to help me cope with anything. And
it was just, it meant something more suddenly. It wasn't what it was in London. We had just seen a bunch of shows close. We had seen people die, and it was awful. And then all of a sudden, it was just this beautiful, beautiful voice.
It turned out Mamma Mia, the flimsiest of musicals, was exactly what people needed.
This was not Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf time. This was Mamma Mia time.
There was this huge energy. It was like a tsunami of energy that was coming at us. You could almost feel the hair blowing off your head. I think that was the payoff for all of us, is that we realized, you know what, as fluffy as we think this show is, it's allowing people to not think about what's going on outside in the world.
And Mamma Mia kept going. Now it's the eighth longest running show in Broadway history.
I just see it as the whim takes me, because if I feel like I need to feel good and see something that I really, really enjoy on stage, that's when I get a ticket to Mamma Mia.
This is George Moskowitz. He's a Mamma Mia super fan. He's seen the show a lot, 20 times. And that means George has also seen how it's changed over time. He says the audience is different. 14 years into the run, they aren't as excited as they used to be.
The audience didn't get up and dance much, you know, and then I wanted to, and I felt foolish being one of the only few that were getting up and dancing.
Ticket sales started to depend on whether people from out of town were seeing the show. No tourists, no sales.
They don't have signs on them saying I'm a tourist, so you don't really know, but you can tell. And yeah, I would say that it's become, since those beginning years, it's become a very, very touristy show.
And while the audience has evolved the show, it's kind of stayed the same. Mamma Mia superfan David has seen the show 40 times, so he knows.
A box of wine does not age, it does not mature, but it also doesn't really go bad. It just sort of stays the same. And whether it's Chardonnay or Chablis, or whether it's Cabernet or Merlot, it's still a box of wine.
So Mamma Mia is a box of wine.
Mamma Mia is a nicer box of wine. It's a Chablis.
But even boxed wine has an expiration date. So Mamma Mia will close. It will have had a long run, longer than most shows can ever hope for. And even if it wasn't the greatest musical, kind of never wanted to be. It mostly was just a good time. And sometimes, there's no harm in that. For Studio 360, I'm Tobin Lowe.
Mamma Mia will pull the audience out of their Broadway seats and onto the dance floor one last time on Saturday, September 12th. Coming up, most writers work long and hard over their work. I started the unfinished book I'm writing now more than a year ago. But the fiction master Anne Beatty knocked out her latest collection of short stories in just a few weeks while her husband happened to be out of town.
One a day.
That's incredible. Anne Beatty gets us up to speed. That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. For a writer like I was, coming of age in the late 1970s and 80s, there were not a lot of fiction writers worthier of emulating and envying than Anne Beatty. Her first novel, Chilly Scenes of Winter, came out just as I graduated college, and then every few months I'd eagerly await her latest short story in The New Yorker. Her characters, a lot of them uncertain young people, often too smart for their own good, seemed like perfect exemplars of people feeling a generational post-60s hangover. And ever since, Anne Beatty has remained one of this country's great fiction writers. Her character's average age has increased, but the psychological insight, the melancholy slash humor, and the uncluttered style really haven't budged. And now she's got a new book of short stories just out. It's called The State We're In. It is her first collection in a decade, and it's terrific. Anne Beatty, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
So your early stories were often set in New York, and as somebody who had just moved to New York, it made me love them all the more. The stories in the state we're in are almost all set in Maine, where you live, I guess, half the time?
About half a year, yeah.
When did you stop wanting to write about New York? As soon as you left?
I write about New York still, I think, a lot of the time. This is a very particular assortment of stories, all written in a quick time period. And
what time period is that?
Last summer.
15 stories, one summer?
18. I threw three out.
Really?
Yeah.
So like one and a half a week?
One a day.
That's incredible. And you hadn't, again, these first book of stories in a decade, you just decided suddenly the beginning of last summer, screw it, I'm going to write a book of stories.
I had no idea I was writing a collection of short stories that would go together with one another. My husband was away on a trip with his brother.
That's always good.
Yeah, he was gone for a few weeks, and I was just amusing myself. I was just having fun because I do love to write.
And are you, in general, a polisher, reviser, rewriter?
Well, yes and no to that question, as to so many in life.
Pretty much all.
If I really don't have a rough draft that I like by the time I get to what would be the ending, I almost never work on it anymore. It gets totally thrown away. Huh. So that isn't polishing. That's temper tantrum, and then it's over. I mean, because I don't sit down to write with an outline or anything like that, what I have to do is use both parts of my brain. I have to use the part that's creating the story, but then I have to not get inhibited, because if in some way I don't have any idea about where I should start to shape the story or what its trajectory is, that's a bad lookout.
So you have to let that editor part of your brain in occasionally.
Yeah, definitely by the 50% mark of what you're guessing would be midpoint of your story, you got to let that editor in. Yeah, absolutely.
One story in this book is set in New York called Major Maybe. This doctor in Maine remembers the apartment she lived in the life she led in New York City back in the 1980s. That seemed, knowing your history, like the most one-to-one autobiographical fictionalization here.
Yeah, you're right. It's right up there.
Were you at all reluctant to revisit this time and place that figured so prominently in so much of your early work?
I think, like a lot of writers, I don't want to just indulge in pointless nostalgia. You never know until you try whether you're going to transcend something that really is only anecdotal.
So you might have ended up throwing it away.
I might have ended up throwing it away.
There is a group of recurring characters in these stories, and in particular, this teenage girl called Jocelyn, who is staying with her uncle and aunt in a little town in Maine while her mother recovers from surgery. And she's really at the center of this book. What made you decide that?
Well, when I was working in Rough Draft, to tell you the truth, Jocelyn just started to run away with one of the stories. So
she's a great character. She is both deliberately and unwittingly funny, and she's annoying and lovable. In other words, she's like an actual teenager. Are there teenagers in your life from whom you could draw bits and ways of speaking and ways of dissing the world and all the rest?
Well, I would sound like more of an authority if I could say, yes, there are. I mean, does it count that my goddaughter just graduated from college?
Yes, that counts.
Well, I certainly knew her and other kids during their teenage years. I think it's more that I observe being in that kind of a community, especially in the summer, because it's such a beach community. There's such an influx of families, to tell you the truth. And teenagers are everywhere, not just in Maine, but I couldn't help but notice what was going on.
And you eavesdrop.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
And thinking as much as you did writing these three stories, essentially a novella in thirds about this teenage girl, did you have a sense, teenagers are like this today as opposed to when I was one in the 60s?
Well, I think literarily the way teenagers are always a help is that they do tend to tell you, even if you're not very happy with how they express it, what they think and what's on their minds. I mean, teenagers will certainly argue with you more, in my experience, than somebody else your age.
Yes.
It's certainly true that and friends my age are not going to argue to the death, you know, about something that we disagree about, but a teenager would question me all night.
Yeah. You were, again, when you were 30, called, I'm sure, many times, a voice of her generation, as now people in TV like Lena Dunham are called of her generation. Was that a burden, that kind of emblematic praise?
I thought it was extremely funny, of course. I mean, for better or for worse, I'm certainly not an egomaniac. I'll give myself that. Yeah. I took a lot of kidding from my friends. And, you know, whether anyone believed it out of the media as a quick form of shorthand, I wouldn't know. I think not.
But did it affect, like, I have to be careful. This next thing I write had better be X, Y, or Z because they think I'm the voice of a generation or I'm a fraud or any of those things?
I know it sounds really strange and as though I'm dissociated from my own mind and body or something like that. But, you know, when I sit down to write, all of those things absolutely fall away. It's true that if I'm writing over a period of days, I can think, have you covered this territory before? Are you doing something that's just become habitual? And that, of course, creates anxiety. anxiety. And then, you know, probably I don't continue writing that day, or I do something totally from left field to shake myself up. But no writer likes to feel that, oh, they're in their groove. I mean, you're playing jazz. You hope it's never played the same way twice.
Yeah. Has the way you write changed over the years in a significant way?
You know, I think in some ways, looking at the state we're in a little more objectively, as though I was, you know, just picking this up as a book that happened to be in my house or something like that, I think probably I had been teaching in an MFA program until a couple of years before I wrote this book. And I'd been at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And by the time I sat down to write what turned out to be the stories in this book, I was really wanting to write more simply. I didn't want to be having that voice of the teacher that I had to use with my students in the back of my mind. And I wanted to do something that was as direct as I could possibly make it.
So do you feel like having taught all those years that no longer teaching people how to write to the degree that can be done is, do you feel liberated? Like, whew, now I can just do my own thing?
I'm afraid it affected me more than that. I'm afraid it's still, you know, that little voice that, again, isn't a bad voice to have. But I don't know what to say about now how difficult it is to keep my critical faculties out of being articulated in my own mind. I don't mean that it stops me midstream and I start critiquing myself. I only mean that since I got so interested in going in that direction, I have to worry somewhat whether inherently that doesn't leak over even into first drafts of my work.
Really? That's interesting. So you're saying that by teaching writing in an MFA program, that sort of vented the self-critical aspect and now it's bothering you as you're trying to write fiction?
To some extent, yes.
How interesting. Speaking of jazz, music comes up a lot in these stories. I counted references to Patsy Cline and Blondie and Cyndi Lauper and probably more. Are musical references like that and pop culture references generally decorations, or are they meant to influence the meaning, voice, appearance of a story more deeply?
Well, you know, I think it was Flannery O'Connor, right, who said in one of her essays that fiction really has to come to the reader through the senses. And she said, quite rightly, that it's very difficult to get the sense of smell into what you're writing. And it is. You see people remark on the sense of sound, of course, much more than the sense of smell. And, you know, I'm in New York City today. I'm sure I've smelled many different smells, but it's the music that I heard today. Not that I turned it on, but in every place that I went. I went to the Museum of Modern Art, and they were showing a video of Billie Holiday singing an original recording. I ate lunch at a sushi restaurant. They were playing Beach Boys, you know, from the 1970s. But we always have a soundtrack to our lives. It's not necessarily even that we choose it. If you move around this world, you're gonna hear a lot of music.
And by the way, New York doesn't smell as much as it did when you were living here.
That's true. I agree with you, actually.
Ann Beattie, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
Ann Beattie's new collection of short stories, The State We're In, is out right now. And finally, a piece of sad news this week. The filmmaker Wes Craven died at the age of 76. Last year, we asked him to judge one of our favorite listener challenges. People had to make short, scary films. Craven was incredibly generous with his time and a complete pleasure to hang out with. I remember how our contest winner really couldn't believe he was getting a call from the mastermind behind Scream and Nightmare on Elm Street. Hi, Jake.
Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jake. Hey, this is Wes Craven.
Hi, Mr. Craven.
How you doing?
Really well. It is an honor to get to talk with you, man.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, I just thought you might like to know that you are the winner.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I'm kidding. No, I'm not kidding.
That is amazing, man.
You are the winner.
Wes Craven told me that as a kid, he didn't revel in horror or scaring people at all.
I was, you know, one of the quiet kid in school. I was the one that got chased around by the bully. So the way people look at people who make scary films is kind of backwards. You know, it logically you would think, oh, they must be scary themselves. But a lot of them grew up being the kid who was scared of the bullies and the crazies and getting beat up. So you
that pretty much means all artists. But
yeah, well, it does. And it you know, when you sit down to think of somebody scary, you can just think of somebody from when you were in sixth grade getting beat up all the time.
And he got the last laugh. He used the name of that sixth grade bully for his most famous villain, Freddy Krueger. Wes Craven, we miss you.
Studio 360.
And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our team consists of
Jenny Lawton,
Louis Mitchell,
Sean Ramosferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Emil Klein,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
He's 19 feet tall, marble, and kind of homely.
Lincoln is not the most classically beautiful face. You know, he was held in such esteem, but Lincoln is such a screwy-looking guy.
Join me and Sarah Vowell to figure out how the Lincoln Memorial became an American icon. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI.